Welcome to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and today is our monthly edition of Bird News, and with us is Mark Faraday, wildlife biologist at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Amy. Good to be with you.
And we welcome you to join in the conversation with your bird or wildlife questions. The number to join is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark, it is still summer according to the calendar, but many species of birds have already left on the fall migration. I think some species might even start as early as July. Who are some of the first species to take off for the warmer climates?
Yeah, that's right. It is fall from the perspective of a lot of different birds, shorebird. And then there are some early songbirds that are mostly gone right now, like orchard orioles. They tend to migrate quite early, and by September, it's unusual to see any. Yellow warblers are still around, but they do start quite early. And I've been seeing reports from some folks I know in Belize. For weeks now, they're already seeing our North American breeding birds showing up there. So by August, some of these birds that we consider our birds are already back on their wintering grounds where they spend far more of the year than they do up here. It probably makes more sense to look at some of these neotropical migrant birds, things like purple martins and a lot of the flycatchers and thrushes and tanagers and warblers and species like that spend the breeding season here, really just June, some of May, June, and into July, and then they're already thinking about getting out of town and in fact, getting out of town and heading back south. It makes more sense to think of them as like Central and South American birds who come up here for a summer vacation to raise their kids.
And do we know why they do that? Why do they come up here for breeding and nesting?
Nobody's ever solved that mystery of why birds that evolved, down in the tropics there would evolve to undertake these perilous migrations. The easy answer everybody gives is they're a tremendous insect and other food resources, just blossoming across the temperate regions at this time of year, like up into Arctic regions, really. And the most extreme example of this seemingly ridiculous life history, if you're migrating tens of thousands of miles a year, is, shorebirds that go up to the high Arctic tundra to take advantage of these huge blooms of insects in the tundra pools and things like that up there, where it's worth their while somehow to do this migration where there's tons of risk. I mean, just imagine flying from Alaska, over to the East Coast, down over the ocean to Central and South America, during hurricane season. Mm-hmm. Somehow that evolved to be worth their while, though it doesn't make any sense when you look at it, what we think of as objectively.
That's right, with a non-bird brain. Before we move on to migration, I just have one other question about these species who come up here for nesting and breeding. Do they tend to just have one clutch of chicks? Because I know that robins tend to have more than one, at least I've seen that in my yard. And I'm wondering if the birds who come up here for such a short period of time only have an opportunity to do that just once.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. So the longer the migration, the more likely it is that they only have one opportunity to breed. And again, the extreme example is shorebirds. They basically have a month. And so if their clutch of eggs gets eaten by a Jaeger or an Arctic fox, or their chicks get eaten by snowy owls, there's no second chance. They don't breed that year. And so you'll see some early migrants among the shorebirds, right in the beginning of July into mid-July. And those might be these failed breeders who are like, well, better luck next year. Time to head south. As you go further south into where we are, they have more opportunities at our latitude. So a warbler that migrates in from, Central America in the spring could have a few opportunities to breed potentially if the nests get eaten. But it's unlikely that they would have two broods, which is probably what you were asking.
Yes. Yep. So
robins. I mean, robins are wintering locally. They're short distance migrants. That was a good example of a bird that doesn't migrate very far. So that gives them a lot of breeding opportunities. They come back pretty early, and so they could have multiple clutches. And things that don't migrate at all, they have a lot of opportunities. Things like Carolina wrens. So they could breed a few times in a summer, and then they're taking that risk of staying for the winter where they suffer a lot of mortality. So it sort of balances out.
Oh. And migratory times are also a great opportunity to see birds that we don't normally see in our region. And, Mark, there have been some rare birds sighted in the last week or two. What are people seeing?
Right. Late summer is kind of a great rarity time when a lot of birders like to come to the Cape from different parts of the region, following up on some of the things that people saw or looking to find their own goodies. And it's often shorebirds. I mean, it makes sense. You think of what we are on the Cape. We're a big sandbar full of marshes and mudflats and good shorebird habitat, and we have places like Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge, all of those barrier beach systems, the outer beach systems there, and then Wraith Point, which is the envy of the East Coast for seabird watching. Birders, throughout the country covet the seabirding opportunities we have at Wraith Point. And so some of the things that have been seen that are bringing people in are an American avocet has been at Seagull Beach in Yarmouth, which is not it's not typically a place that gets rare shorebirds. And so good for Seagull Beach. Usually, historically, it was always these barrier beaches of Chatham, it's kind of far-flung beaches, Monomoy, South Beach, that would get all of the rare bird attention. And then you'd have to charter a boat out there. It used to be easier to get out there, so there's this whole machine of birders chartering boats to get out to Chatham to get the rare shorebirds, but that's less of a thing now. It's much harder to get out there, and so I think that's good in a way because people are finding things elsewhere, closer to home, and we're realizing that there are lots of good places to find rare birds. anyway, that's the American avocet. It's a pretty cool bird. I mean, it's a sandpiper, I guess, but it's very different than what you would think of your average sandpiper. It's very lanky, tall. It's got a crazy upturned bill, kind of a specialized bill for sweeping back and forth across rich mudflats, scooping up food. In breeding plumage, they're really interesting looking. They have this kind of mustardy yellow head and striking kind of black and white wings and body, and just crazy, crazy long legs. They're silly looking. They're not from around here. So that's a genuine rare bird that's been bringing folks to Seagull Beach. I'm not sure if it's still there. It was there for quite a while, which was nice. It's always nice when the rare birds stick around so people have a chance to catch up to it. Right now, it's Wraith Point. Wraith Point in Provincetown is just cornering all of the rare bird markets. And it seems like people are going out there more than they were 10 years ago. And I think it's maybe because they can't get to the places in Chatham as easily, and because a group of seabirders have been spending tons of time out at the race, out way out by the lighthouse, which is hard to get to. You have to walk out. Most people have to walk like 2 miles to get out there. But folks have been seeing such good stuff out there that people are doing that, and they're going out there more and more. And so now it's not just seabirds out on this big, wild, sandy beach. You'd think that's all you'd be able to see. People are turning up rare songbirds there for some reason. And the reason is that it sticks out into the Atlantic, and so it tends to catch any rare bird that might be out over the ocean. But they had a yellow-headed blackbird there this week, which is a western species that you would not expect to see here on the Cape. But mainly it's this laundry list of seabirds, that really cool seabirds that are very, very hard to see anywhere else. You either have to be in a boat or in the Pacific Ocean to see some of the things that are regularly being seen at Wraith Point. I mean, it's really astounding and worth the effort to get out there.
And I will say from your bird news last week, take your camera, because capturing an image is always the best way to document what you've seen or to try to identify what you've seen.
Yeah. Yes. And so anybody, any of these birders trekking out to Race Point, they certainly are not leaving their cameras at home because of the whole, you know, photos or it didn't happen is the mantra online these days, especially with birding. But yes, I had a really rare bird that maybe we'll talk about at some point, but I was wishing I had my camera, to say the least.
And I have a quick question about that. In the birding world, is it, especially the folks who are trying to do that 100 species or the big year or something like that, is it done on trust and faith, or are people supposed to be documenting what they see or hear?
It's a mix. And so the common thing is you get a pass on. I mean, did you really have a house finch? I don't know.
Right.
You know, and other things, you know, it is basically an honor system. But when it comes to the real rarities, for what you're talking about is very few people get involved in this kind of competitive level birding where there's a final tally of how many birds they saw that year that is awaiting record committee confirmation of some of the rare birds that they saw. There's not that many people doing that kind of rare bird or that big, serious kind of competitive listing.
Right.
But it gets a lot of attention because it's so quirky. But very few birders actually do that.
Before we head to the break, we have Peter giving us a call from Provincetown. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, what's your question or comment?
Well, it's a mourning dove question. Last year, from my kitchen sink on a hanging plant outside the window, I got to watch a pair of mourning doves nest and got to watch the little birds fly off about a month later. Well, this year I have mourning doves in the same place. They started nesting in the beginning of July, and now this is 2 months later, and I don't think they're going to hatch, but they're still there. So I'm just wondering how long they're going to stay on the eggs for.
Interesting. When did they lay the eggs again?
The beginning of July.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, they should hatch within 2 weeks.
Exactly, but they're
are they staring? Are you saying they're still staying
there? They're still there on top of the eggs.
All right, well, don't hate on me, but I've never considered mourning doves very bright, and this is yet another example of that. Just from what I've seen, watching mourning doves in various parts of the country over the years, I've done a lot of nest monitoring for different jobs. You know, back when I was in my 20s, all around the country, and yeah, mourning doves. They're successful because they breed early and often, not because of any intelligence that I have been able to discern. But in fairness to mourning doves, I've seen other birds do this. There was a pair of American oyster catchers in Chatham whose nest that I was monitoring. It was on Turn Island in Chatham, which is a Mass Audubon property. And they continued tending these eggs for a long time after it was clear they wouldn't hatch anymore. And then one bird finally got the picture and left. And then this one remaining poor bird was just hanging out by these dud eggs, you know, long after it was clear they wouldn't hatch. And so, yeah, they must have been infertile or something happened to them that made them infertile. But, that will happen sometimes. And that is the basis of how some people manage house sparrows in nest boxes. So if you have bluebird houses or, tree swallow boxes, house sparrows are often a problem. They're not native and they're aggressive and they will kill chicks and eggs. And so people will often manage them. And this is what we do at the sanctuary is we will remove their eggs and put fake eggs in. And so they will keep incubating these fake eggs, and it keeps them busy and keeps them away from your bluebirds and your tree swallows. So you're taking advantage of, you know, I call it not very bright, but I guess it's just a very strong instinct to continue incubating your eggs. You can take advantage of that to manage house sparrows.
Peter, thanks so much.
So they can stay there for much longer?
They shouldn't be there at all. I mean, there's no... Somebody should, like... you should take down the nest so they get the hint and, you know, for their own self-preservation. I mean, you don't have to do anything. Nobody needs to do anything. I'm sort of kidding. But, I mean... There's no reason for that nest to still be there or for them to still be there. That would not hurt them if the nest fell down or something like that. They'd probably be better off.
Peter, thanks so much for the call. Thanks. It's Bird News Today on The Point. If you have a question or a comment about birds or wildlife, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to Bird News on the Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and with us is Mark Faraday, wildlife biologist at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. If you have a bird or wildlife question or comment, you can also send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We got an email from 9-year-old Nate in West Falmouth. He says, there's a pair of swans living near the bike path for a few years, and this summer they finally had babies. They're getting big now, the babies. What will the young swans do? Will they stay in the marsh or will they move away?
That's a good question. They'll stick around for quite a while, in my experience. And I don't know at what point they disperse away from their breeding pond. I suspect it's they'll stay, like a lot of young birds, until they're driven away by the parents, and that will depend on, you know, what the resources are at that particular pond. You know, if there's enough food for everybody, they might be able to hang out, and you'll just see this flock. And the young ones are easy to pick out for quite a while because they're kind of dusky looking. So they're not pure white like the adults. And so you'll see them hanging out in family groups for long periods. But I don't have a specific time that they stay with the family group before dispersing. I think it varies. Good question.
Elsa says she lives in that neighborhood, and she says, I think they're mute swans. What are mute swans? I've not heard of those before.
Mute swans are the only swans we have, really.
Oh.
There are native swans in North America, but some of them are quite rare, and there's only two species. And they're both more upper Midwest through the far west up into Alaska is their range. And though some of them winter in large numbers in the mid-Atlantic, they just don't come through Massachusetts. And so the only swans we have are these non-native European mute swans that were introduced here on purpose for basically ornamental reasons. I mean, they're quite beautiful. And they have quite a following, but they're sort of controversial. Like a conservation organization or a land manager in charge of a property where you might be trying to do habitat restoration or you might want native waterfowl nesting would view mute swans as a huge problem because they're aggressive towards native waterfowl, they're aggressive towards people. They can access vegetation at the bottom of ponds that our native species can't, so they can eat up all the vegetation. And there's just a lot of reasons that mute swans are a problem. And various agencies have done control measures, and it's not always very popular because, you know, oh, the beautiful swans.
Right.
So they're a little bit of a flashpoint between, you know, bird lovers and conservation organizations and land management agencies that view them as a pest.
We have another email. This is from Tara from Saratoga Springs and Eastham. She said, I saw a green heron while paddling Herring Pond in Eastham in early August. It was perched on a pondside tree branch, and I almost didn't see it. It blended in so well and was so still and quiet. I understand that these birds live a pretty quiet and isolated life. So how, when, and where do green herons mate and breed, and how do antisocial birds find partners?
Wait, what was the part about antisocial?
She said, how do antisocial birds find partners? I don't know if green herons are considered antisocial, but they're quiet, at least.
There are a lot of antisocial people out there listening saying, yes, I'm having the same problem. I know I did. I really like green herons, and they're absolutely right. They are different than other wading birds. I mean, they're herons, so they're very closely related to egrets and great blue herons, you know, the birds that we see around. And they tend to all be colonial nesters. So whether it's Florida, Central America, or, you know, one of the islands off the North Shore where they breed, or Monomoy, they breed in noisy mixed colonies of different kinds of egrets and herons, typically. Green herons, not so much. They like to be alone, so they're a good bird in a pandemic. They're inherently socially distanced, of course. And so they like to breed alone in, with one other heron, ideally, in like the woods adjacent to a pond or a marsh. And we've had a number of their nests over the years at Wellfleet Bay, Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, that our crack team of trail naturalist volunteers would find, and then they'd be able to point them out to people. So we were always a good place to see something you don't see very often, which is a green heron nest, because it's usually well concealed. It's about the size of a crow nest, but often very well concealed in some woods near a pond or a marsh. And then you see them, they're generally alone when you see them. They're really cool birds, and they became internet famous, and these videos recirculate every so often. There are some green herons that were filmed using bread at one of these public parks where people feed ducks, so there's bread around. And so they would take a piece of bread, put it on the surface of the water to attract fish, and then eat the fish. They were fishing with a lure. And this was not something they evolved. I can't think of any evolved behavior, any other incidences of this. So this was an incredible example of learned behavior and innovativeness in a bird. And you can Google these videos up very easily. They're pretty cool.
Wow. Tara, thank you so much for the email. We now turn to Patrick, who is giving us a call from East Sandwich. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, what's your question?
My question is, over the last couple of weeks, we've been spotting a large hawk, not a red tail, looked like it had longer wings, maybe a little longer tail, but very large, not as bulky as our turkey-sized red tails here. I'm in East Sandwich. It looks like a rough-legged hawk, and I have a picture of it from below. It was at a pretty high altitude, which I could send in. It has those dark carpal patches. It's not a red tail, but it's a very large, not a chipeter type of hawk. I wondered, my checklist says that they're not here this time of year since they're Arctic breeders, and yet this is a very large hawk, which is not a red tail, and looks to key out as a rough leg.
Yeah. Well, the first problem here is that hawks only occur in New York. So bird would be out
that's where I'm from.
Out of range. Yeah. Up here we have hawks.
I've been here for 37 years and I haven't lost a hawk.
I guess not.
And it's still chocolate and dog. Yeah.
Have a hot dog.
Yeah,
it's probably, it would be monumentally rare for it to be a rough-legged hawk. I mean, we get them in winter in very small numbers, so they're rare even in the appropriate season. This is an interesting hawk. It's closely related to red-tailed hawks. It's one of the beautios, the soaring hawks, but it's a high Arctic ground nesting, pretty uncommon hawk overall. And they always are over big open areas. And so the best place to see them in Massachusetts is always the gigantic marshes of Parker River National Wildlife Refuge, Plum Island, up there in Newburyport. And they are occasional on the Cape, like in the great marshes behind Sandy Neck, sometimes out at High Head and Truro, but not very easy to see on the Cape. But that would be like from November onward would be when you start seeing those guys. I would guess it's a red tail. They're pretty variable, but I would love to see the photo. So, yeah, you can send it to the radio station. They can, WCAI.
Well, Patrick, send it to thepoint@capeandislands.org, and I will send it along to Mark for you. I'll be curious to
see
it as well.
CapeAndIslands.org.
Correct, yes.
There you go.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. I'll send you the picture off quite soon. You should be able to see it in about 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Great.
Mark, people might not be aware that thousands of birds at this time of year are on the move because they do it at nighttime. What initiates this mass migration of thousands of birds at once on a particular evening? And if we're interested in observing this mass migration, what are some tips?
Yeah, you have to have good ears. And so, yeah, this is really cool. I mean, what you're talking about is the fact that most songbird migrants, the ones we were talking about at the beginning of the show, that are migrating this time of year into October. They're migrating from Canada, you know, New England, to Central and South America. And most of those birds, the songbird variety, do it at night. And the reasons they do it at night, you know, we're assuming, is because the air tends to be less turbulent because you don't have rising currents of air from the heating of surfaces on the earth. The air sort of calms down at night, and it's cooler, and they tend to generate a lot of heat doing all that flapping, incredibly energy-intensive to be flying nonstop across many states at once. And also, there are no hawks and falcons at night, and so they're pretty safe. And so what causes them to take off and launch all at the same time, which happens sometimes, is really the wind conditions. So around here, if there's like a light northwest wind, the birds will take just some kind of a tailwind, a nice, you know, northerly, not too strong tailwind that will send them on their way. Calm night, they will, and clear night also. They can use the stars to some extent. It has been shown through research, as well as the magnetic field and broader landmarks and other things. So they're using a variety of clues to migrate. But when they're migrating at night, they are able to use the stars. It's everything about this is just mind-boggling that they can do what they do. And so when they're doing this, they give little contact calls. They're not in flocks really, but they will end up in these kind of loose mixed species aggregations. And for whatever reason, they give these little contact calls, which probably, you know, helps keep individuals from going way off course. And they're species specific, and people have studied these. So if you have really good ears and you go out on a night that is a good night for migration with, you know, light northwest wind, something like that, this time of year through October, and October you'd be hearing more sparrows and some of the later warblers, but they all give these little flight calls, and some of them are very species specific. Like the thrushes have some really unique ones where you can identify the species just based on the little flight call they give. The warblers tend to be a little more difficult, but people have developed software where you can record them and then identify them using the software.
And are they flying at an altitude where if it were a clear night, and you had some binoculars and maybe a little moonlight that you could actually see them, hear them and see
them?
Yeah,
people have done that. If there's a full moon in a good place, if you sit there and watch it or set up a scope on it, you can see little shapes. The river of birds, you know, otherwise invisibly migrating south over our heads. And sometimes it's really obvious. I remember when I lived in South Florida, there was so much of it. I mean, so many birds kind of funnel through the south tip of Florida and then kind of launch out over the Caribbean. I remember bobolinks, those grassland nesting birds, that really long-distance migrants that go all the way to southern South America, and just standing outside my suburban house in Homestead, Florida, and just like one bobolink after another, the calls were overlapping, just bink, 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 bink. You're just this river of bobolinks going over. So sometimes it's really obvious. Other times you might just hear a few little, you know, just a little nothing, little chip note or lisping call.
Right.
But if you know what to look for, listen for, it's really, really cool.
We have an email from Faith. She says, Oh, Elsa's playing something here. Can we see if she can get it again? Migrating birds? I'm not sure.
Oh, wait, was I supposed to... Wait, what? That was audio?
Okay. Oh, Elsa says it's a bobolink. Yeah, maybe you couldn't hear it. We have a quick email from Faith who says, I enjoyed lots of red-winged blackbirds at my feeder and deck railing on West Falmouth Marsh from March to July. We returned to New York for the 4th and stayed for a week. Have not seen them since they returned. So that would have been in mid-July. What happened, she says, or asks.
Red-winged blackbirds?
Yeah, so it sounds like when they returned in mid-July, no more red-winged blackbirds.
Yeah. They flock up. They get the flock out of town. So blackbirds start flocking up pretty early in the summer. They're early breeders. They're early. I mean, you're talking about species that arrive back to this area in grackles and red-winged blackbirds in February. So, you know, these guys get down to business breeding pretty early. And by midsummer, they're getting into these kind of pre-migratory flocks and just sort of roaming around. And so, you know, maybe your local ones disappear. It's often most obvious with grackles because grackles just come through suburban neighborhoods, especially ones with oaks with acorns, and they'll just come streaming through, you know, 400, 500, 700 grackles. And all of a sudden, they're in your backyard in this big noisy flock. And that'll be happening through the fall. And then pretty much all grackles and most red-winged blackbirds leave this area for the winter. You'll see a few here in the winter, but they get out of town. But, yeah, some of them will leave your local neighborhood earlier in the summer than you might expect.
Yeah, that sounds like... Thank you so much, Faith, for that email. It's Bird News Today on the Point. If you have a question or comment about birds or wildlife, you can give us a call at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to Bird News on the Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and with us is Mark Faraday, wildlife biologist at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. If you have a bird or wildlife question or comment, you can also send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark, in June, I emailed you because I had heard an unusual chickadee in my yard. It was this three-noted chickadee, and I was able to record it on my phone, but Dan Tridle, our ears for the station, said, Amy, that audio is not good enough for broadcast. But thanks to Brian Morris, our former Morning Edition and All Things Considered host, he cleaned up the audio for us, and so we have it. So I'm going to ask
him. Did he set it to music?
No, but you can hear. Let's give a listen.
Come on, Brian.
So is that indeed a chickadee? And if so, has anybody heard this call before?
So I couldn't hear it through the phone, but you know I've heard it before.
Yeah.
When you sent it to me, and so I did a deep dive into this, and I guess not deep enough, or maybe I hit my head on the bottom or something. I don't know what happened, but I thought for sure because there has been research into this, and it's been well known in ornithology circles for a long time that the vineyard and the vineyard has it's funny, I'm hearing it where I am. They're listening to the show.
Oh, good. So I'm glad you got to hear it again.
Yeah. It is exactly three blind mites. And I looked and looked. I Googled my heart out. And, you know, this one paper kept coming up about how there's a unique chickadee song type on the vineyard, and Don Kruzma was the lead author. He's an old professor of mine at UMass who spent his career studying bird song and how it evolved and how they learn and everything. So he's the guy. But I can't find anything with this three blind mice thing. And so if anyone else has heard this, I guess we need this is the age of crowdsourcing. And so we need to find out if anyone else has heard this. It's super distinctive, even for the average person. To recognize and describe. So maybe somebody else has heard that.
Right. And I've heard it at least one more time in the same, it's up in these high oaks in our front yard. So I have heard it again. it was probably in early August, but I haven't heard it since.
Did you see the chickadee?
I did not see it. No, with the leaves on the oaks, it was too tricky to spot them.
I have to think about it. Chickadees are not, so their close relatives, the titmice, are well known to be, they're like jazz musicians. I mean, I've been birding since I was six. That was 40 years ago, and I'm still hearing things pretty regularly from titmice, where I'm like, I don't know if I've ever heard them do that. Just like, you know, varying the tone and the pitch and the rhythm of the typical calls that they do. But chickadees, not so much. Chickadees are really, they just do the same thing. They have their very small repertoire, relatively speaking, compared to other songbirds, and they just do it over and over again, and there's very little regional variation. Once you get to, like, New Jersey south, you start to get Carolina chickadees. They have a, they sound kind of similar, but they have a different song there, it didn't sound like that either. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a mystery. You've got a special,
special little chickadee there. We got an email from Joseph in Joe in Wacoit says, I understand why birds call to attract mates in spring, stay in a flock during travel or migration, and even to warn of nearby raptors. But I also observe bird calls for no apparent reason. Two examples: hummingbirds chirp frequently while slopping down nectar, and towhees are very vocal while scratching around in the brush. Any idea why these types of calls happen?
No, that's a very good question, because I've observed the same thing, and most people who closely watch birds, a hummingbird gives soft little chip notes constantly when they're flying, almost as if they want something to be aware of them. I don't know what. Maybe somebody has looked into this. I've never looked into it. Why that might be? Oftentimes with this kind of a question, I mean, how would you even set up an experiment to discern why they do that? You know, you can't. And so it comes down to guesses, and evolutionary biologists would be, well, it seems that it might be adaptive in this way. You know, but everybody is really just sort of making educated guesses. And there are these whisper songs, like you're talking about towhees kind of calling when they're scratching around in the ground. I mean, that might be communication with other birds in their family group, just kind of like, oh, hey, there's some worms over here. You know, I'm not sure.
Come join in.
That would just be a theory, because they're often, you may see them by themselves, but there are probably some other towhees not far away. The mate and the young of the year might still be around. But there are these whisper songs that a lot of different birds have whisper songs that are like a quiet, kind of charming, jumbled little warble that they do that's different from their advertising songs that are strident, loud, you know, here I am, this is my territory, come mate with me kind of stuff. And I'm not sure how that functions. Like, sometimes if you follow a crow as it's walking around, it'll be making all these soft little sounds, seemingly, it's like it's muttering to itself. I have absolutely no idea what the function of that is. And blue jays, too. Blue jays have a whisper song that is their song. I mean, think of blue jays as being loud, obnoxious, monosyllabic brutes. But they have this charming little whisper song that they will do if you get close enough to them. All of the jays do, as far as I know.
Another miss.
But yeah, it's a good question.
All right, we have Becky giving us a call from Harwich. Good morning, Becky.
Hi, good morning. And my question is about my early morning walks in Harwichport down at Bank Street Beach. I've noticed several times now, I was really surprised, city pigeons that I had never seen on the Cape in the 40 years I've been here. So I'm just a little curious about what you might think about city pigeons on the Cape.
Is this a euphemism for tourists? Are we talking about the tourists? No, you're really talking about pigeons, aren't you? Well, yeah, everybody from the city
just
comes.
Regular city pigeons, yeah.
This time of year, they're not. I mean, you call them city pigeons, but they're just pigeons. They don't call themselves city pigeons. They occur.
They like
farms. They're not. They're really not common on Cape Cod, and you recognize that, and that's why you're asking this. But anytime you're driving down a highway, and there's a farm next to an overpass, it will be a flock of pigeons. Note that. Next time you're driving, they like highway overpasses to the extent that birders call them bridge falcons, because they kind of they look like falcons and they fly very fast. It's sort of a birder joke. Birders are very funny. But they like agriculture and they like harbor.
Around farms.
The only places on the Outer Cape where you can count on finding pigeons are Wellfleet Harbor and Provincetown Harbor. And there's probably a couple of other places that people know about, but those are the big public places where there is a resident big flock of pigeons for whatever reason. And they'll walk on the shoreline, they'll walk on the beaches, and they're kind of opportunistic. They're seed eaters. It's not really clear to me what they're even eating, but they like harbors, and that's the only place I know. It's kind of a running joke on the Cape Cod Christmas bird count, which runs from like Harwich to Wellfleet, such a South Wellfleet. And often, 30 of the best birders in the Northeast come back at the end of the day and nobody has seen a pigeon. There's sort of disappointment in the room because, that would have been one more species for the count. But, I mean, that's how uncommon they are out here.
Becky, thanks.
They're not limited to cities yet.
Becky, thanks for the call. We also have Tom on the line from Harwich. Good morning, Tom.
Morning.
Wow. Oh, I hear a chickadee. Is that
I've always been able to call chickadees in, but I have heard different accents, like the vineyard is just a single note. And if you listen closely, there's three notes in there. Sounds like just two for the normal call. And the ones on Nantucket are a little different. But over here on the Cape, I hear them sometimes just do two notes or just one. And it's always spaced evenly between calls. So I do mine, they do theirs in response. They come a little closer. If you don't hear them, they're in flight coming in closer. And if you slow it down, it actually sounds like there's two sets of vocal cords in there. It sounds like two instruments that does the call. It's very melodic, and I think it's basically their happy song. It's not a threatening call or a warning or anything like that. It's or a territorial one. I just think it's their happy little song.
Yeah, I agree. That's I had a birding friend years ago, and he said his mnemonic, the typical mnemonic for the chickadee, that one is Phoebe, just from the old, the Peterson Guide and whatever. But he said he thought they were saying happy,
right?
And it would you'd often hear it on an unusually nice day in the spring, or a warm day in the winter or something like that, but where you're happy. So yeah, I can buy that.
If I'm out in like the northern Pennsylvania woods and you don't hear anything, no bird calls at all, I can start the chickadee call, and they'll come from far away, and then they bring like a posse with them wherever they go.
The
titmice.
The rule is there's always 12. If there's one chickadee in the winters, mostly. And the seasons when they're not breaking off into breeding territories, when we do our Christmas bird counts and we use our trickery to get the birds active, like a screech owl call, one chickadee comes in, I almost automatically write down 12 on the sheet because there will be 12 total.
Well, Tom, thank you. You had both Elsa and I scratching our heads thinking, where did that chickadee come from in the studio? So thanks so much. Thanks so much Thanks so much. We have an email here from, I want to squeeze these in, from Naomi in Woods Hole, who says, a white bird landed at Stony Beach around 6 p.m. on Monday, maybe about 4 feet tall. Was it an egret or a heron?
Well, that's a really existential question for the taxonomist. Egrets are herons, and herons are egrets, basically. The great blue heron and the great egret, as of 20 years ago, I can't remember when they did it, but they're in the same genus. and we call one an egret. Oh, there's a. I'm actually in Draket right now. I'm in a woodsy suburb of Lowell near the Merrimack River, and blue jay just flew overhead doing a perfect red-tailed hawk, and they've been doing that. I've been hearing this alleged red-tailed hawk, but I knew it was a blue jay, and I just got confirmation of that. What were we talking about?
Not blue jays. egrets or herons, about, or both.
I egret digressed. They tend to be egrets if they're white. I can't remember the reason for that or the history of that, but they're all very closely related, and they're all basically herons. But it sounds like you probably saw either a great egret or a snowy egret. Those are the two common white egrets that we get here. They're especially common midsummer onwards. They've dispersed from the breeding colonies, and they're just hanging out in salt marshes and salt ponds for the most part, fattening up and getting ready to head south. Neither of them winters here. They're heading down to Florida or maybe even Central America, but pretty common this time of year.
We have an email from Lee in East Ham who says, is it time to stop grape jelly for Baltimore Orioles and time to start suet again?
Yeah, there's no hard and fast rule, especially here on the Cape, because a lot of people, not a lot of people, but a few people will end up with Orioles all winter long. I stress, it's very uncommon. But you can find, if you bird hard enough in the right places, like especially East Ham, Chatham, East Orleans, there are these certain places where it's not unusual to find Orioles into winter and sometimes overwintering. And so, you know, keep out grape jelly as long as there's something to eat it. There are no rules, and nothing bad happens either way. And then it's the same with the hummingbirds. People think there's some, you know, law enforcement organization will show up and issue a citation if you keep your feeder up too long. But keep clean hummingbird feeders up for, you know, into the winter. There could be a rarity that shows up. And so when to put out suet, there's no reason you couldn't do it year round. It's just not really necessary in the time of bounty, late spring through summer. But birds will take suet if you put it out there any month of the year. Birds will most likely take it. But you know, when it starts to get crisp and more fall-like, seems to be when people feel like suet is appropriate. But you could do it whenever.
And if we keep our bird feeders full, we might even get a chance of seeing some rare bird on its trip south, right?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. That certainly has happened to me, and yeah, that is absolutely correct.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for today. Mark Faraday, wildlife biologist at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Thanks, as always, Mark.
Thanks, Amy.
I'm Amy Vince. Thanks for listening.